Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloen. Later on in the program, we'll be joined by our friends Carla K. Morton and Alan Berkelbach, the Poets Laureate of Texas, that are embarked on a project to visit every one of the parks in the National Park System. Morton and Berkelbach made friends with Lisa Carver, an acclaimed country music songwriter formerly based in Nashville who moved to New Mexico to find a life more connected to nature. They collaborated with the poets writing the lyrics and Carver producing the music and performing a newly released song called Just Go Around. But first, we look at the complex and fascinating topic of innovation. What does it mean to innovate? And where do we humans come up with the next new idea that leads to a revolution in our social attitudes, technology, the arts, and sciences? Our guest is Kara Miller. Her podcast, Innovation Hub, is produced by WGBH in Boston, which literally is in a hub of innovation in a city surrounded by academic institutions like MIT and Harvard, as well as being the historic home of many of the world's most innovative people, from Ralph Waldo Emerson to John F. Kennedy. Miller's podcast, inspired by her interest in political innovation, covers such a wide array of topics that it's impossible to list them all here. But we'll talk about some of them as she joins us from WGBH Studios in Boston, Massachusetts. Kara Miller, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks, David. Thanks so much for having me.
And it was so fun to discover your podcast, and it's been a joy to listen to, although I have to tell you about a funny experience I had last night. I was listening to one of them, and I forget which one it was, and fell asleep, and then I woke up, and I heard you, I thought, talking to people about the Dead Sea, and I said, well, that's remarkable. I just did a program about the Dead Sea. That's fascinating. And then I realized it was actually my show playing.
So you, like, had grafted me into your show. So really what you're saying is I've already been on your show.
Yeah, so it was, well, it was just a funny experience. It's like, oh, no, I'm listening to me. That's not Kara anymore.
Right.
Hey, tell me about your background. How did you first get interested in audio reporting, and especially as relates to science and technology issues?
So it's a long and strange story. My plan for a while was to be an English professor. And I was going to grad school in English. Sorry, this is, you can see, this is going to take a while to get to hosting a radio
that's
show.
Okay. I like long stories.
Okay. So here it is. So while I'm going to grad school in English, I would write sometimes for, like, local newspapers about politics and culture. I've always loved the news, always been really interested in the news, particularly in politics. So after a while, doing some of that writing led me to doing some TV analysis, like political analysis on, like, local television stations. And but I had been doing that for a few years by 2008, by the time of the 2008 election. And I ended up doing some political analysis on TV for WGBH, which produces the radio show now. And when I got a chance, I did a little bit of subbing for TV. And then when I got another chance, I did a little bit of subbing for radio. It was for a daily live show, so really, really different from what I do now. But I really liked it because TV, first of all, there's makeup that you just, I mean, I felt like I could never get it off. Like, I felt like it was on for years, and I couldn't get it off.
Yeah, and I know. I've had friends in the TV business, and that's just, that's one of the things about it. And the makeup, it just, and you can, when you have high-def television, which we all do now, people just don't look that good on with all that makeup on.
Exactly. So you just don't have to worry. That's the nice thing about radio. You don't have to worry about high heels. You don't have to worry about makeup. You don't have to worry about any of that stuff. And the other thing, too, is very often on radio, like, producers will let you go longer. You can have longer discussions with people. So I just really loved radio. At some point, I graduated from graduate school and started, actually being a professor of English. But I kept doing this, like, moonlighting of media. And then more and more and more, I wanted to sub on radio. And then when this radio station was kind of, like, really, really tiny and had really just started, it was maybe like a year and a half old or something, I pitched the head of the radio station on like, how about if we did something on innovation? And he was like, okay, we'll try it. And it was on Saturdays at 7 a.m. initially. And that's how I got into doing radio. So through a bunch of side doors.
Well, you bring up an interesting point about radio versus television. And, you know, there's been lots of talk over the last few years about, you know, radio in decline and, you know, that it's a dying medium. But I beg to differ, especially because of the world of podcasting now. But the interesting thing to me about radio is that when you talk about television, you watch, people tend to watch television communally. You know, you might watch it with your spouse or your family or your friends. You know, you might watch it by yourself too. But radio is very singular in that it's very intimate. For example, right now, whoever's listening to us out there, and there are thousands, but each one of them, really, it's just them by themselves. So it's you and I and one other person. And that's the intimacy of radio that I love.
And I think one of the neat, you know, I talked about the makeup before, but the sort of, you know, deeper level of that is that when you watch television, there's lots of things that can distract you from what the content is, right? Whether it's what somebody's wearing or the makeup they have on or that they got a new haircut or what the graphics are on the screen, all that stuff. And there's something about radio that lets you really think about an idea without a lot of the clutter that sort of can be superimposed over it. I mean, I just know when I listen to radio, I'm really, really thinking. I'm not distracted by, like, you know, what the person looks like. I mean, there's a sort of focus that I think can be true of radio that is harder with TV.
Yeah, and at the same time, oddly, you can do other things while you're listening.
Yes.
You know, things that might be tasks that you may not enjoy as much, the radio can keep you company, you know, whether it be doing the dishes mm-hmm. or, you know, mowing the lawn or on the treadmill, whatever you're doing, you know, that radio entertainment can kind of take your mind off of the meniality of what you're doing and let you enjoy kind of doing both at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of let your mind work while your hands are doing something, as you say.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the concept behind your show. Why innovation? What got you interested in that? Because that intrigues me.
So, you know, I wish I could say it was like this really well thought out, you know, we storyboarded it up kind of thing. But in fact, I think the original thought, so it was going to be, originally it was a local show on in Boston. And I think one of the sort of pieces behind it, in terms of me and Phil Rado, who does and did run the radio station then, was the idea that this is a really innovative town and that people tend to think about innovation. I think this is still true in a kind of often singular way, which is like connected with technology, that innovation is an app or, you know, a new browser or that sort of thing. And in fact, there's this world of ideas and there's, you know, a world of medical, you know, and drug discovery. And there's just like there's innovation in education. So I think we were trying to think about innovation here in Boston. And then as the show started, I quickly followed my own interests, which are diverse. I mean, like, I came out of, you know, the humanities, and I'm interested in people who do innovative things in education and people who do innovative things when thinking about politics and the economy, as well as innovative things in science. And, you know, so I think I've always really wanted to think about this idea of innovation is that, like, it can happen anywhere with anyone in any sector. It's not like the property of, you know, the world of technology.
Yeah. And here's a good example of that is one of your recent programs that I listened to was on the nature of evil and how we think about that.
Uh-huh.
And I found that fascinating because, like you said, that's more of like how we think about something and how we approach it, you know, mentally, emotionally, spiritually as a human being, that's not about technology.
Right, exactly. And we are always looking, the evil story is a really interesting one. I interviewed Julia Shaw, who's a researcher out of the UK. And we're always looking for the most recent research in any domain that helps us see the world differently. And one of, I think one of her really interesting points, we started off talking about Hannah Arendt, who in the 1960s lived in New York, but she had grown up in Europe and she became famous. She's a political philosopher, sort of became famous for this phrase, the banality of evil. And in 1961, she really wanted to go see the trial of Adolf Eichmann, who had been part of the Nazi high command. He had fled to Argentina. He had hid out pretty successfully for quite a while. And then he had been discovered and he was brought to Jerusalem and put on trial. And she flew from New York to Jerusalem, to the district court, to watch this trial. And one of the things that was really striking to her, and was also striking to the psychologists who evaluated Adolf Eichmann, was what a normal person he seemed to be. And so she talks about sort of what we understand about evil and maybe rethinking it, because maybe it's something where we think of these sort of binary of like, there's good people, there's bad people. But what does it take to move somebody? Maybe it really is a spectrum. And certain kinds of things move people one way or the other on that spectrum. What does it take to move somebody? And why do some people get moved and other people don't? And, it, you know, I just thought it was such an interesting. I mean, I don't think very much about evil or the concept of evil. But, you know, I thought.
Yeah. And I prefer not to, but I right. still found it fascinating. And one of the things I really found interesting was the concept of the murder fantasy. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us just briefly about that?
Sure. Well, Julia Shaw talks about, you know, whether it's this, you know, whether you imagine that you're or you just sort of imagine somewhere in your mind, maybe it's kind of out of your control, killing somebody that you know or that you don't know, but generally, you know, somebody you're having an issue with. And she talks about how incredibly common that is and how ashamed people are to talk about it. But in fact, it's very common. And actually, you know, evolutionary biologists think to some degree what you might be doing is thinking about potential concepts, like here's a route I could go. And in thinking about it, you like exit out as like, no, that would not be a good route to go. So in some ways, thinking about it is helping you play out a scenario and reminding you this is not something I'd ever want to do. But she just talks about how incredibly common it is and how rarely spoken about it is.
Well, and it's interesting because it's not just about, you know, murder is like the most extreme version of that.
Right.
But we all
right.
face choices constantly in our daily lives to do the quote unquote right thing or, you know, sometimes the easy thing, which may be, you know, the quote unquote wrong thing. And when I got to thinking about after listening to that section of your interview was it's kind of to me a form of, you know, our own internal self-protection mechanism. In other words, you know, I decide that this is not good for me down the road. These are going to be these terrible things and I'm going to feel bad about myself. And so I'm actually just protecting myself by choosing not to do that bad thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think some people think about dreams this way too, that in some ways dreams allow you to play out scenarios that probably will never happen. And it's not necessarily even that you want those things to happen, but that your mind is running through different options. I mean, almost the way a computer would. And it's like, nope, this is not the way to do it. But, you know, when you talk about like those choices people face all the time, every day, in some ways it makes you think a little bit differently about like the criminal justice system. Or, I mean, most of us are not known by the worst thing we ever did on our worst day. You know, if whatever that thing is, whether it was being mean to somebody or just really doing something that we really regret and that we really never should have done. You know, people who get locked up for the things that they did, that becomes the defining event of their lives. For most of us, the worst thing we ever did is not the defining event of our lives. Most people don't know about it, and we're never going to tell them about it. And so I think that's an interesting piece of it that Julia Shaw also brought in.
You are listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. After a short break, we'll continue our conversation with Kara Miller. She's the host of WGBH Boston-based podcast Innovation Hub. Stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our conversation with the host of the Innovation Hub podcast, Kara Miller. Miller's program takes a deep dive into a wide array of topics that all deal with the concept of innovative thinking that lead to changes in how we interact with each other and the world around us. And one of my favorites was the program you did about the electric guitar.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The story of Leo Fender and Les Paul. I loved that one.
Oh, thanks. I mean, I think that, you know, that kind of speaks to this idea that I was talking about before of like innovation being big. And I don't know anything about guitars. And so when we were like, oh, we're going to do how the electric guitar changed the world, I was like, well, we have to do this in a way where people who don't know anything about guitars, you know, I wouldn't know the difference between a Fender guitar. I have no idea. I said, we have to do it in a way that makes it accessible. And it ends up being this kind of, you've got multiple, you know, sort of layers to the story. But one layer is that there's these two people, Les Paul and Leo Fender, and they're kind of like frenemies. And they're both working on developing electric guitars at basically exactly the same time in the 40s and the 50s. And the other piece of their story is that neither of them like rock and roll. So when rock and roll takes off and they're using electric guitars, Leo Fender and Les Paul are basically like, what the heck is this? This stuff sounds terrible, you know? And it speaks to like when you have an invention, and this is true of everybody who's ever had a good invention, after a while, you can't control it anymore. And like what, you know, imagine the people who created the transistor, like they could never have imagined what we've done with the transistor and how many places it is. And in the case of Leo Fender and Les Paul, they were like, this music is just terrible. But it was their music in some ways. It wouldn't have existed without them.
Yeah, that reminds me of the story of Michael Faraday, who invented the first electric motor, essentially. And it was very primitive and really couldn't do much of anything except move. And the story is, and I'm not sure if it's, you know, if it's an actually true, this happened, is that the Queen Victoria asked, well, what good is it? And his response was, you know, madam, what good is it, baby?
There's another Michael Faraday story I heard where I think it's Michael Faraday where somebody like demonstrated electricity in a lab and similar, you know, somebody's like, what would we ever do with this? And he said, I don't know, but I'm sure you'll find a way to tax it. And of course, that's exactly what happened.
Well, that's for sure.
Yeah.
One of the other things I loved about the story of the two electric guitar makers was, and I'd never thought about it this way, and I think it's great when you come at something the way you're talking about, because you're not an expert on electric guitars.
Right.
You can help bring all of us along with you in your voyage of discovery and learning. And one of the things I found interesting was that the Gibson guitar, the Les Paul, mm-hmm. had kind of a almost like a grungier sound to it. I forget exactly how you described it. And whereas the Fender guitar had a brighter sound. And then you kind of compared the use of the Fender guitars by the Beach Boys with the Rolling Stones. And I thought that was like fascinating. And you could really hear the difference in the two different kinds of tones in the guitars.
Yeah, and how in some ways, because of their sound, different kinds of groups were attracted to different sounds. Like, you know, that the Beach Boys, you know, in the early 60s, they had an image and it was like very clean cut Southern California surfer, and they chose a cleaner sound. And the Rolling Stones, who are a lot more like disheveled, sexy kind of band, chose this muddier sound, which in some ways, you know, matched up with their image. And we also talked a little bit about when Bob Dylan went electric at the Newport Folk Festival and the kind of scandal that caused, and the, you know, electric guitars changed from being just an invention that two guys had been working on and kind of competing over, and it became like a way of measuring cultural change, you know, a way of looking at the way that kids and their parents felt differently about music and felt differently about what was okay and what was not okay. And then there was a rift between folk music and like rock music when Dylan went electric. And It's just really interesting to think about how just like one little instrument has all these kind of layers to it of change and how it changed the world.
Oh, yeah, certainly, especially when you think about the British invasion of the Beatles, where, you know, before you had music for the generation before them, you know, were bands. And by bands, I mean, you know, dance bands. So you had to have a lot of musicians. And then, as you pointed out in your program, now you could just have, you know, four people, you know, fill a hall with sound because of the electric guitar. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the fun things, too, about that segment, and we did a segment about Motown several months ago, but with both of them, whenever we do a segment on music, I have to figure out how we can do more segments on music. I'm not quite sure. But is that just getting to hear. You know, getting to hear like Buddy Holly on the Ed Sullivan Show, or getting to hear when we did the Motown thing, you know, Diana Ross and the Supremes went on a show, and I think it was What's My Line, but people were supposed to guess, a panel of celebrities were supposed to guess, you know, who was the real Berry Gordy, right? I don't remember. What is that old show? Is it What's My Line?
Oh, yeah. I think, yes. Well, that wasn't called What's My Line. Yeah.
I think so, right? Where there's like three people, two are imposters and one's the real person. And one was the person who created Motown, Berry Gordy Jr. But the Supreme, you know, just digging up some of these archive tapes of like music and people, you know, telling their own story of why they did things. We had Les Paul talking about how he was 13 when he started to try to electrify the guitar.
Wow.
It's so fascinating to get to hear some of this archive stuff.
Yeah, that also reminded me of a story of the great guitarist for the band Yes, Steve Howe. He had a Gibson Les Paul, and he could make that thing sound like, you know, he was taking you out into space with that guitar, the sounds he could make with it. And it was just amazing. And he used to take it on air flights, and he would buy it a ticket. And the ticket read, you know, the passenger was Mr. Gibson. Mr. Gibson had his own seat. I'm curious about maybe some stories you could tell us about when you came up with an idea or something, one of your favorite stories, where you discovered something quite unexpected along the way.
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of people I've interviewed who have helped to convince me of something that I don't know that I was quite on board with before that.
Can you give us an example of one of those?
Yeah, I can give you a couple. So one was this professor at Yale named Paul Bloom, and he wrote a book called Against Empathy. And it was literally arguing against empathy, which you would think is crazy. And, you know, don't we need more empathy in this world? And he made a really compelling case, which is that, you know, though we talk a lot about empathy and want people to have it, the empathy that people tend to have is for people like themselves. And so relying on empathy versus, let's say, statistics, which might seem a lot colder, generally pushes people to want to save, you know, the girl who fell down the well kind of thing. You know, like situations that don't apply to very many people, but you feel a lot of pain for the people who are going through them. And you tend to ignore people in places where there's not a video camera, they're farther away, they don't look as much like you, it's hard to understand the situation that they're in. And he made this argument that people think, like, you know, if only we could put ourselves in other people's shoes and realize the pain they were in, that would be good. And he made this really compelling argument about, like, he had looked at a lot of documentation from the Civil War. And he said, you know, it's not like the people who wanted to keep plantations didn't have empathy. They did. They had empathy for the people whose lives were going to be destroyed by a political system completely changing, by slavery changing. They had lots of empathy, but not for slaves, right? For their compatriots. And he says, you know, that's true in every situation. And so he really argued that in some ways what we should do is move away from empathy and, like, put a little bit more green eye shades on and really look at, okay, how many people is this disease affecting versus what we think is true, or, you know, a specific case that we saw on television. And it's a touchy subject and hard to think about, but I just remember thinking, like, wow, I have never thought about this argument, and it's very interesting.
It's really compelling.
Yeah. 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 And it's something you don't think you're going to be convinced of until he laid it out.
Yeah, that is, because if you were just to say, you know, you shouldn't have empathy, or empathy is not as good as you think it is, you know, most people would say, well, you know, that doesn't sound right.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. And that's, you know, the purpose of a program like yours. Can you give us maybe another example, or one of your favorite stories where you it's kind of fun, you know, when you go down the rabbit hole and you really get into something, it's going to be really enjoyable to do all that research.
Right. Well, I mean, two that I'll put together in a group are, we talked to this professor named Sarah Igo at Vanderbilt about privacy and the history of privacy. And then we also talked to, these are two separate segments, but they kind of, in my mind, sort of, they taught me something similar. And then we also talked to Jill Lepore, who's a professor at Harvard. And both of those segments talked about the evolution of technologies and how we've often thought that technology, essentially, we're not that different than we ever were. You know, we often think right now, oh God, technology, it's a mess. It's really hurting things. It's hurting kids. It's taking away our privacy. It's polarizing us as a nation. And it's not that there isn't some truth to all of those things. But the fact is that people have been thinking those kinds of things for a long time. So Sarah Igo, who writes about privacy, I'll give you a few examples from her. When the postcard was first developed, just a little bit over 100 years ago, people started really panicking about privacy, because if you think about it, right, I write you a postcard, what I write you is like clearly visible to other people, like the person who's delivering it, maybe neighbors, maybe other people in the family. And people thought of it as a real invasion of privacy. Another thing that people thought was a huge invasion of privacy was instant photography. So for a long time, photography has been around for a good long time, 150 years or so. But for several decades, you had to pose for a photograph, and it took a while, and nobody was like surreptitiously taking photographs of you because it took too long to be doing that. But then around 1900, people did start getting these little cameras, and they could snap pictures in much the same way that, like, you know, you might remember snapping a picture when you were younger before we all did it with our phone. There was a very famous case of a girl, I think she was 16, and she had gone to a photography studio. Her picture had been taken, and it just showed up in advertisements for flour, for like flour that you bake with. And there was just this whole explosion of concern about, oh my gosh, our privacy has been taken away. Now people can just take pictures of you. You don't even know if they're taking a picture of you. How can you even control, you know, the images of you that are around? And I just heard those stories, and, you know, I feel like, you know, they resonate so much with.
Yeah, because you think about now with, you know, what everything people post, like every detail of their lives on social media with, you know, with pictures of what they're eating, where they're going. And, you know, it's just amazing if you think about how far we've come since those concerns.
Right. But one of the points I think that Sarah Igo made is that we've always been worried. In one way or another, we've always been worried about the privacy that we're losing. And you could argue, in some sense, even though I take your point that, like, we put a lot about ourselves out there. In some ways, you know, hundreds of years ago, when we lived in smaller towns, when more of us lived in small towns, it was hard to go anywhere or do anything without anybody knowing your business. Now, I may not be private to my credit card company, but I could get on a plane tomorrow and go somewhere, and nobody at my work would know where I was, and I'd walk across the street in, you know, Rio de Janeiro, and nobody in Rio would know who I was. And in some sense, you could argue, that's a kind of private, that's a kind of anonymity that would have been impossible for most people in 1700.
Yeah, well, I live in a fairly small town of a few thousand people. And I have pretty much complete anonymity when I walk around and when I go places. People don't know who I am. And because there's just enough of us that, you know, we might recognize, oh, I've seen that person before. But we really do. We do have lives of anonymity. I never thought about it quite like that.
Yeah. So I thought that was interesting. And it just is in this vein of, you know, however much we think things have changed, they're often a lot more like the past than we somehow think. And Jill Lepore made this other kind of like other side of the coin fascinating case about different kinds of technologies, but I'll tell you about photography since we just talked about that. She talked about Frederick Douglass, the really famous abolitionist and writer. And when photography became more of a thing around the time of the Civil War, Frederick Douglass really believed that photography, that the telegraph, that steamships, that they would make people less racist. And he thought that because he felt that, especially in the North, people could not see people who were different from them, you know, especially the lives of people in the South. And if photography could allow people to see a world and hardships that they were not a part of, they would see that those people were just like the people in their family, just like the people in their town, just like their friends, and that they wouldn't anymore have prejudice against them. And that is like the other side of the coin, is that very often when technologies are new, we think this will solve things, like this will bring the country together, this will do something that so far hasn't happened. And usually that doesn't quite pan out either. Not to say technologies are good or bad, but they're not cure-alls. And, you know, I mean, so I just thought that was so interesting that that's what Frederick Douglass thought.
Let's take a short break. But when we come back, we'll finish our conversation with Kara Miller, host of the Innovation Hub podcast. Coming up in just a bit, we'll be joined by country music songwriter Lisa Carver. She collaborated with the two Poets Laureate of Texas, Carla Morton and Alan Birkelbach, to write a song about their take on the importance of preservation of wildlands and our national parks. You won't want to miss it. Stay with us. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlohm. Let's rejoin our conversation with Kara Miller. She's the host of the Innovation Hub podcast from WGBH Public Broadcasting in Boston. As a creator of content like this, I'm curious as to your creative process. Do you, when you go, because I experience this, where you have a guest and you research it and you get excited about it and you have an interesting conversation with them, like what we're having right now. I hope you people out there think this is interesting, because I sure do. And then it's over and it's behind you, and it's kind of, I always have that feeling of kind of sadness. It's like, oh, that was really good, but now it's on to the next thing.
Well, I don't feel that way because we edit our show, so I know I'm going to hear them several more times before the show is done.
So then you'll be sick of me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have listened usually like, so I, when I interview somebody, so I'm trying to think, like, let's just pick Sarah Igo, you know, about the evolution of privacy and our concerns about privacy. My guess is I probably talked to her for 45 minutes and we probably aired 20 minutes of it. So once we interview her, it's this iterative process between me and whichever one of the producers is producing that segment, where we kind of go back and forth and think, what should we take out? And then very often I will write a lead that tells a story. So I started that particular one with Sarah Igoe about privacy with the story of this girl, I think her name was Abigail Robertson, who literally just saw herself on a flower poster and thought, how did I get on this poster? I never posed for, like, what's going on here? So we turn that into what we call this cut and copy lead. So it's like me tracking, you know, I'll be telling a story interspersed with tracks from the guest. So after I talk to somebody, there's a lot more work to be done on that person. And usually it's a couple weeks then before sometimes it's way more before the actual interview airs. But I love that I get to be exposed to new ideas all the time. I think that's so neat.
So what's your favorite part of, what do you enjoy most about your work?
I mean, I think the best thing about it is that I get to talk to so many smart people with different ideas. It's really neat to be able to get a book, like we get a lot of review copies sent to us, or to read an article and to say, I'm really interested in this. Could we bring this person in, or could we, you know, set this person up at an NPR studio so I can talk to them? To me, that is the best part. Well, there's another great part, which is that I really like writing. And so, like, very often in these beginnings of these stories, like electric guitar, or Motown or whatever, we have this story of, you know, I'm narrating it and there's these little cuts in from the person that I interviewed. There might be some sound from the time, like music, or we're working on this week's show has some of Walter Cronkite talking about the Pentagon Papers. And I love writing and I love storytelling. So that's also, I think those are the two best parts, is one, getting to meet really smart people who I feel like make me smarter because I don't know about electric guitars until somebody tells me about them. And then the other is just really liking to write and put the story together.
If you were to ask me that question, it would be quite similar. I just enjoy all of the different wonderful minds that I get to come across in my interviews.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you can't beat it. Like, you know, it's being in a class all the time and you're kind of choosing who the teacher is, and they're often just so brilliant about their different topics, and they're making you think differently about things that you've sort of believed your whole life to be true but aren't necessarily true.
Well, we're about out of time, but before we let you go, can you maybe give us some hints about some things that you're pursuing for the future?
So, I talked at the beginning about always being interested in politics, and that remains true. So one topic that we're working on is sort of looking at how the way we look at politics has changed recently, just in the past maybe decade or two, and how that's really changed the political landscape, and talking to some great minds who've been doing research on this, sort of looking at, okay, why is this? What happened? How did politics go from being a list of issues you believed in to a tribe that you belong to? I find that really interesting.
Oh, yeah. And that's definitely very pertinent to the world we live in today.
Exactly.
Well, Kara Miller, it's been a joy talking to you. And best of luck with Innovation Hub from WGBH and on NPR podcasts. Thanks so much for joining us on Blue Dot.
Thank you so much. It was so great to be here.
Thanks to Kara Miller, host of the Innovation Hub podcast produced by WGBH in Boston. Coming up next, we're joined by Carla Morton and Alan Birkelbach and Lisa Carver. Morton and Birkelbach, both Poets Laureate of Texas, joined us last year to tell us about their project to write poems in conjunction with visiting every one of the United States national parks. I had the great pleasure of being their guide on their visit to Lassen Volcanic National Park, which is just about an hour away from where this show is produced. Carla texted me to tell me about a very special collaboration that arose from their project with acclaimed country music songwriter Lisa Carver. Carver wrote many songs for famous Nashville-based artists with names you might recognize like Willie, Reba, Tim, Dolly, but she decided to relocate from Nashville to get back to her roots as a lover of the real world, and when she connected with poets Carla and Alan, who wrote a lyric wrapped around the concept of preservation called Just Go Around, magic happened. Take a listen.
You say you don't need the mountains, and you don't need the trees. You don't need living waters or unpolluted breeze. And why should you care where the bald cypress grows, or where the wolves, the big cats, or the buffalo go? But we all need the wildness of this holy ground. Oh, go around, son. Go around, go around, where dark is still dark, and the night still holds stars, where hoofprints and footprints outnumber the cars. Progress has a place in the world that surrounds. Oh, go around, son. Go around, go around. Keep your drills, keep your pipelines. Don't you bring them, don't bring them inside. Don't trim the borders. Don't poison the waters. Don't dam sacred rivers from the outside. Oh. We all need the of this holy ground. Oh, go around, son. Go around, go around, go around, son. Please go around, this is sacred ground. Go around, son. Oh, go around.
You just heard the new song, Just Go Around, composed by our good friends, the Poets Laureate of Texas and lovers of the national parks, Carla K. Morton and Alan Berkelbach, along with their good friend, country music songwriter, and the amazing performer of the song, Lisa Carver. They all joined us from New Mexico via Skype. Carla, Lisa, and Alan, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you. Happy to be here. So happy. Thanks so much, Dave.
Honor and a privilege.
Well, Carla and Alan, you've been on before, and we're longtime friends. Before we talk to Lisa, tell us where you're at in your quest to visit every national park in the national park system.
Well, we are 44 parks into our Words of Preservation and Poets Laureate National Parks tour, fixing to head out this coming weekend to Capitol Reef, Bryce, and the Grand Canyon National Parks. We are having an incredible adventure.
And I also want to point out to our listeners that just about everywhere you go, you send me a postcard, and I just love them. So keep those cards and letters coming, folks.
Yeah, we're old school, you know, poets.
I love the postcards. Okay, well, let's talk about the genesis of this song, Go Around. Lisa Carver, you were a Nashville songwriter, and now you live in New Mexico. Is that right?
That's right. That's correct.
And I'd like to know, how did you get to know Carla and Alan, and how did this connection come about with writing a song with them about their experiences with the national park system?
Yeah, I met Carla actually up at Red River. I think it was the Folk Festival. We have some mutual friends in a band called Granville Automatic. And we just kind of hit it off right away. And I think it was your birthday the next day.
It was my birthday, yeah. And the full moon.
The full moon. And yes. We went zip lining in the next day, beautiful autumn leaves. And we just hit it off. And she started reading me some of her poetry. And I kind of came out to New Mexico after a midlife crisis slash breakdown and was definitely disillusioned with music, the music business. And I just felt my spirit coming back listening to her poetry. And then I met Alan through Carla at a biker festival in Red River, which is hilarious if you know. And I just fell in love with both of them, their spirits, their passion for the word, for poetry. And they're just beautiful human beings. So
we love you too.
Yeah.
Aw. And tell us about, when did you guys decide to write a song together?
Well, Alan, did you want to take this?
No, go for it.
Well, you know, when Alan and I are on this big tour, we try to get to as many places as we can by car. We just, unless we have to fly like to Samoa or Alaska, we're in the car, in the truck. And so to pass the time, we write song lyrics, and we wanted to write something for the national parks, dedicated to the parks and to the rangers and everyone who works so hard to preserve and protect these places. And we wrote this and went, oh, I wonder if Lisa would like to see this. So we asked her if she would like to write the music, and she did. She didn't hesitate. And what she did was just make it magic.
And Lisa, from your perspective, you know, once you got a hold of their wonderful poetry, you know, what's the process that you went through of, you know, igniting your muse to write music to that? And tell us a bit about your love of the national parks.
Well, I had an absolute love given to me by my parents, who would take us as little kids to the Smoky Mountains camping. And my dad was definitely a country boy. He loved the outdoors, and we picked up on that. And when I was 10 years old, we moved to a little island in Alaska, a little island in the southeast called Chickagoff, and lived on a religious commune. But that's a whole different show. But, I mean, getting out in nature, it saved me. And I just have such a love and respect for the spiritual and renewing properties of the great outdoors. And sometimes you forget when you're in Nashville. I never really felt like I was outdoors. You know, I would go hiking in Radnor Lake, but a lot of it, you know, man-made stuff. And to come out to New Mexico and to hike with my dog and to fall in love with the mountains and the rivers and the great outdoors again. And then to run into these two poets who, this is their passion. This is what they've been called to do. I believe it's a spiritual calling for both of them to not only see these, and I've been getting the postcards too, by the way. So I feel like they've kind of taken me on their adventures with them. And it has renewed my love again. I look forward to visiting these places. And I think that's what this song really did for me, was even though I've been to quite a few national parks and I loved being there and I love the experience, this makes me want to visit and protect them all. I mean, this is something that every person in this country should be invested in.
But Lisa, you know, you mentioned that you worked in Nashville and in the country music industry, and it almost just struck me when you were talking about that a moment ago and your experiences there, that we think of, you know, as country music, and yet, you know, here you were there and starved from actually experiencing the life of being out in the country.
Well, you know, a lot of people that work in that industry are great at getting outdoors and hunting and fishing and doing those things. I didn't do so much of that when I was there. But I do love that a lot of people in that industry are big believers in the outdoors. There's certainly a lot of, you know, songs about that. But a lot of it comes also from a party aspect, or, you know, let's go pull the pickup down in the meadow, which is great. That's, you know, obviously fun stuff. But I love, as I get older, I feel like I want to carry some weight, some depth, do something that really makes a difference and matters. And I feel like Carla and Alan have inspired me with this song and with their poetry and with the fact that they're spending their valuable time going and visiting places and bringing attention to them. And yeah, it's kind of, I think I'm just at a different point in my life. I'm on the back nine and I'm going, how can I use my gifts to make a difference the way these two incredible people are making a difference?
Alan and Carla, you know, I'd like to know from your point of view, when you met Lisa and connected with her, what was it like for you when you know she said, yeah, I'll help you out with this and write the music for this? And what was it like when you first heard, you know, it's one thing to have your beautiful lyrical poetry, but when you hear it set to music, that's just a whole nother level.
I cried. I did. It is a whole different level. Poetry has a way of reaching in from one heart to another. I believe that. But when you add a layer of music to it, that enhances that, and it makes it spiritual, I think.
Yeah, when the when we actually had the song recorded in the studio, the man who was doing the mixing for us, after Lisa sang her vocals on it, he turned back at us. He said, "That was unbelievable." And wow. We were just sitting there just crying our eyes out because it was so beautiful.
It was your first take, too.
What's wild is I consider myself more of a lyricist. And it's hard for me. It's very intimidating to try to put music to someone else's words. So I have to say, even though I said, yeah, I would love to, you know, give this a shot, I was pretty nervous about it. And I knew they wanted an earthy, organic feel. And I paced a lot with my guitar going, oh, how do I do their beautiful words justice? So I think we all pulled together. It was a great team effort.
Absolutely.
It was an honor. Yeah.
Thanks again to our guests, songwriter Lisa Carver, poets Carla K. Morton and Alan Birkelbach, and the creator of the Innovation Hub podcast, Kara Miller. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. You can check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org. Never miss an episode. Subscribe to us on NPR Podcasts via the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Blue Dot is distributed by PRX. Hey, that's the Public Radio Exchange. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Our producer and engineer is Mr. Blue, Sky Schofield. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.